Good afternoon. This is KMXT, and this is the Midday Report. It is noon. Coming up, Kodiak's Emergency Operations Center releases more COVID-19 data. The Kodiak Island School Borough School District has released its three finalists for the superintendent position. And where to find N95 masks on the island.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President Joe Biden is celebrating a strong jobs report that beat expectations. NPR's Franco Ordonez says the economy added 467,000 jobs last month, even as Omicron cases surged.
The January jobs report is welcome news for the Biden administration, which did not expect such positive numbers. Speaking from the White House, Biden said the report was a sign of the grit and resilience of the American people, as well as American capitalism.
Our country is taking everything that COVID has to throw at us, and we've come back stronger.
The unemployment rate rose slightly from 3.9% to 4% last month, but that's being attributed to the fact that nearly 1.4 million people entered the job market. While infections have begun to recede, the count was taken in January, just as Omicron cases were peaking, giving analysts hope for a more rapid recovery after Omicron. Franco Ordonez, NPR News, The White House.
A new Pentagon report offers a revised account of the chaotic aftermath of an Islamic State suicide bombing at the Kabul airport last August. NPR's Greg Myrie reports a blast killed more than 180 people, including 13 U.S. troops, just days before the final U.S. forces left Afghanistan.
The ISIS bomber detonated explosives filled with ball bearings among a crowd of Afghans desperately trying to leave the country and U.S. troops guarding the airport gate. The next day, General Frank McKenzie said U.S. forces and ISIS gunmen had exchanged shots after the explosion. But now, McKenzie says,
we now know that the explosively fired ball bearings caused wounds that look like gunshots. And when combined with a small number of warning shots, that led many to assume that a complex attack had occurred.
The report says there were no ISIS gunmen and that warning shots fired by U.S. troops did not hit anyone. Also, there's no evidence that the Taliban knew of the ISIS attack in advance. Greg Myrie, NPR News, Washington.
The father and son sentenced to life in prison by the state of Georgia for murdering Ahmaud Arbery are pleading not guilty to federal hate crimes charges after a federal judge rejected a plea deal. For member station WABE in Atlanta, here's Alex Helmick.
Earlier this week, Travis and Gregory McMichael had reached a plea deal with prosecutors. The two were already serving life without parole in state prison for killing 25-year-old Arbery, who was black. Under the plea deal, they would admit the killing was racially motivated, would get 30 more years in prison, and be moved to federal custody. The family of Arbery opposed the deal, and the judge nixed it, saying she did not want to be bound by the sentencing guidelines. The McMichaels, along with William Bryan, chased Arbery through their South Georgia town in 2020 before Travis McMichael shot and killed him.
This is NPR News. The opening ceremony for the Winter Olympics took place in Beijing today, with hundreds of athletes from around the world marching into China's National Stadium. NPR's Brian Mann reports these Olympics are framed by concerns over human rights in China and by the coronavirus pandemic.
The ceremony was rich in symbolism, showing a confident Chinese culture and industry. China's President Xi Jinping looked on as athletes marched in. Russian President Vladimir Putin also attended after meeting with Xi to talk about trade and ties between the two authoritarian governments. The Biden administration has staged a diplomatic boycott of these Olympics, describing China's treatment of the Uyghur minority as genocide. In the days ahead, nearly 3,000 athletes will compete in winter sport. They're living in a quarantine bubble designed to protect them from the COVID pandemic. Brian Mann, NPR News, Beijing.
In a grim reminder of how much this country has lost since the coronavirus pandemic began 2 years ago, Johns Hopkins University reports a COVID-19 death toll in the U.S. is approaching 900,000. New cases of the Omicron variant are now down in most of the U.S., but the CDC says that on average, more than 2,400 people are dying from COVID-19 each day. The director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, has said that new data show the risk of dying from COVID is 14 times higher for people who have not been vaccinated compared with those who have, not including booster shots. The Dow closes down 21 points. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Progressive Insurance. For protecting everything under one roof by bundling home and auto, learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
NPR News is presentada a usted en parte por la Providence Kodiak Island Centro de Asesoramiento. Para una cita o más información, por favor llama al 907-481-2400.
For KMXT, this is the Midday Report. Kodiak's Emergency Operations Center has reported 42 new cases of COVID-19 since its last report on Wednesday. There are 216 active local cases of the virus. That's a decline since Wednesday when the EOC reported 254 active local cases. There are no current hospitalizations from the virus, and there have been 11 deaths since the start of the pandemic. The EOC reminds residents to get tested as soon as they develop symptoms and to stay home if feeling unwell.
A former student volunteer sports team manager at Kodiak High School has pleaded guilty in federal court to sexual exploitation of a minor. The Anchorage Daily News reports that Vince J. Barcelon Delaguin, now 20 years old, was arrested in May. According to an FBI affidavit, Delaguin created a fake social media account to obtain explicit photos of a teenager he met through his involvement with the team. He then blackmailed and sexually assaulted the teenager before authorities were alerted, according to the affidavit. State charges were dropped against Delaguin as part of his plea agreement. Sexual exploitation of a minor is a felony offense. Sentencing for the case will be held in May. The Kodiak Island Borough School District has released its three finalists for the superintendent position. The district's current superintendent, Larry Ledoux, announced in December his plans to retire at the end of the school year. Two candidates are from Alaska. Andrew Hannibal Anderson is the former superintendent of the Lower Yukon School District, and Debbie Treese comes from the Chugach School District, where she is the executive director of student services. The school district also announced Cynthia Mika as one of its finalists. She's the superintendent of instruction for Little Elm Independent School District in Texas. All three have been invited to Kodiak for on-site interviews and a community tour and forum on February 14th and 15th. The Board of Education intends to announce its pick for the position during that visit. The new superintendent will start this summer.
Kodiak's first shipment of N95 masks from the federal government arrived Wednesday night and will be freely available at Safeway Supermarket. The Biden administration announced last month that 400 million N95 masks would be going to pharmacies and community health centers across the country. In Kodiak, Safeway off Mill Bay Road received 4,000 N95 masks on Wednesday night. Safeway staff said people would be able to pick them up for free by Thursday afternoon. Mask distribution at the store will be self-served, but that doesn't mean it's a free-for-all. The federal government outlined 3 N95s per household as part of its free mask rollout. And Safeway staff say they're unsure if and when they'll receive another shipment, so it's important for people to take only what they need. Pharmacies participating in the free N95 rollout are the same ones that partnered with the federal government to provide COVID-19 vaccines to the public. Safeway was the only location to receive free N95 masks on Kodiak Island. The CDC has recommended N95 masks over cloth ones to help prevent the spread of the Omicron variant of the virus, which has caused case numbers across the country to surge, including on Kodiak Island. A Sitka resident and charter operator has been convicted of felony theft of electricity, and he'll have to pay $150,000 in restitution and fines immediately, or face additional civil charges from the city. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
59-year-old Richard A. Forst pleaded guilty in Sitka Superior Court on January 31st to one count of criminal mischief in the fourth degree, a misdemeanor, and to one count of theft in the second degree, a felony, for the theft of electric power at his home on Islander Drive and at his dock property on Halibut Point Road for at least the last 7 years. Forst was arrested and charged in 2019 after technicians with the Sitka Electric Department noticed that the padlock had been removed from Forst's electric meter and replaced with another not supplied by the utility. A large motor was audible in Forst's garage. The department subsequently pulled the meter and found that two bypass wires had been installed to divert power into the garage without first going through the meter. The main circuit breaker was opened, and the motor inside the garage nevertheless continued running. Technicians later observed that the meter at Force Commercial Property at Guckers Island Dock on Halibut Point Road had been bypassed in a similar manner. Police were informed of the situation. They obtained a search warrant to investigate inside the buildings at the two properties and found that the bypassed circuits were feeding refrigeration equipment. Based on the age of the equipment and further investigation into Force's electrical consumption, the department estimated the value of electricity diverted over a period of years to be around $200,000. Municipal Attorney Brian Hansen appeared at Force's change of plea hearing to deliver a scathing victim impact statement on behalf of all ratepayers in the community.
The city and borough of Sitka is not a cement building at the end of Lincoln Street. It is not a full of faceless bureaucrats. The city and borough of Sitka is approximately 8,500 citizens, men, women, and children in this community who live, work, go to school, and recreate in this community. They also are electric rate payers in this community. Some are in poverty, many are low income, and these citizens plead to our assembly to keep the rates of electricity as low as possible. Mr. Forrest, you stole from those citizens, and you stole from them for years.
Under the plea agreement, Forrest must pay approximately $145,000 in restitution to the city of Sitka and fines just over $5,000. In an email to city assembly members, Attorney Hansen wrote that, "If Mr. Forrest fails to immediately pay the judgment, I will initiate civil enforcement." Neither was Superior Court Judge Jude Pate conciliatory. He told Forrest that had he not accepted the plea agreement, he could have faced 1 to 3 years in prison for the original charge of theft in the first degree and paid up to $100,000 in fines. The original charge of criminal mischief in the third degree carried potential jail time of up to 2 years and a $50,000 fine. Judge Pate agreed with the state prosecutor Amy Fenske that when a citizen of nominal good standing, a prosperous business owner, abuses the system so flagrantly, something more damaging than mere theft occurs.
The bigger and possibly the more long-term harm is, as Counsel Fenske pointed out, the tearing at the social fabric, and that's just the lack of trust that these actions have brought about. In a time where our society is already at odds on so many things, and you pour in this doubt, this mistrust by stealing, it causes citizens not to trust the government, it causes citizens not to trust each other, it erodes our very community.
Judge Pate offered Forrest the opportunity to address the matter in open court, but he declined.
Mr. Forrest, is there anything you'd like to tell me before I decide what to do? You're not required to speak, but if you'd like to speak, now would be the time.
No, Judge.
Judge Pate went on to observe that if the COVID pandemic had not intervened, this case likely would have gone to trial. As a result, public reaction to date has been somewhat muted. In his remarks, Forrest's attorney, Juneau-based August Petropoulos, suggested that the entire question of Forrest's guilt would be moot if two as-yet-unread motions received favorable ruling from the court, the first to dismiss the original indictment and the second to suppress the evidence in the case. Nevertheless, Petropoulos said he wasn't there to litigate and urged the court to accept the plea deal.
But we're taking this deal. I think it's a fair compromise given the two motions that were filed, the fact that Mr. Force has no prior conviction, that this guarantees the city get the $144,924. I'd ask the court accept it.
In addition to the restitution and fines, Forrest will serve 2 years of supervised probation. He also agreed to perform 80 hours of community work service. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
The defense attorneys for defendant Stephen Downs raised many theories about alternative suspects who may have killed Sophie Sergi in a college dormitory bathroom in 1993. Downs is charged with first-degree murder and first-degree sexual assault. As KUAC's Robin reports, closing arguments will be heard today, and jury deliberations may begin this afternoon.
Defense attorney James Hawanek says other men might have committed this crime, according to leads followed by investigators in the years after the murder. One was Kenneth Moto. Moto testified Thursday he remembers being interviewed by James McCann, the Alaska State Trooper sergeant who led the investigation, when McCann flew to Kotzebue in 1996. Moto appeared in court this week on a muffled video conference, saying he volunteered then to give a DNA sample because he wanted to help any way he could to solve a crime against a Native person.
I wanted to help any way I can, you know. If you're Native, you can't have that happen to Native people.
Moto's sister, Karen, had told troopers in a 2009 interview that her brother had confessed to the murder at UAF. But Karen Moto died in 2018. Defense attorney James Hawanek asked Moto about that conversation with his sister.
And do you remember telling Karen at any point that you had killed Sophie Sergi?
No, never.
You never said that to her?
Remember we were watching something on Cold Cases in Alaska? Is some kind of show on TV? I told all the suspects and Sophie, all the suspects and that one at UAS.
If I just heard you correctly, you told your sister Karen that you were a suspect in the Sophie Sergi murder?
Yep.
Okay. But you never told her that you had killed Sophie Sergi?
Never did.
Okay. All right. Nothing further, Your Honor.
Hawanek also raised the theory of another alternative suspect, Gregory Thornton. He was roommates on the fifth floor of Bartlett Hall in that school year with Reuben Leake. Leake testified Thursday he was familiar with guns and knew Thornton had a .22 caliber pistol.
I could never say for certain that it was an H&R pistol. It has the shape and the look of an H&R, but I never read the writing on the side of the barrel to say exactly what it is. But it's a fairly distinct shape, weight, you know, dimensions.
The medical examiner concluded the cause of Sergi's death was a bullet from a .22 caliber weapon. Leake said Thornton was a white man with an olive complexion. Thornton was also one of two people, a witness, Melanie Sigunik, narrowed from a photo lineup a trooper had her look at in 2004. She testified this January 19th. She saw a man with a darker complexion coming out of the women's bathroom in the early hours of April 26th, 1993, the day when Sergi was found dead, hours later. The prosecution and defense both rested on Thursday. Closing arguments are expected on Friday. The courtroom is closed to the public to prevent COVID-19 sickness. But the court system is video streaming the trial on its website. We obtained prior permission to record the proceedings for this story. In Fairbanks, I'm Robin.
The 30-year-old Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act was passed to give tribes a legal avenue for the return of ancestral remains and some cultural objects. But many remains and objects remain in storage and collections of federal agencies and museums. As KNBA's Trip J. Krause reports, several agency and tribal officials spoke to a Senate committee about where the law falls short.
During a federal hearing on a 30-year-old law designed to give indigenous tribes a path toward getting cultural items and ancestral remains back, lawmakers learned how they could make the law better. Rosita Worrell has a PhD in anthropology and served on a National NAGPRA Review Committee for 12 years. She told a U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs that tribes spend a lot of time trying to work their way through this process, and it doesn't always pay off.
Tribes go to a great deal of efforts and expense to bring the case before the committee, a committee comprised of scientists, museum professionals, and tribal members, without any guarantee that the committee's finding will be acted upon. Four, describe a discrete category of funding to support disputes. And then increase NAGPRA funding for tribes and museums. I know that this is a concern.
Federally recognized tribes in the lower 48 can initiate claims, and for about 20 years, Alaska Native corporations were eligible as well. But that changed when the National Park Service declared them ineligible. Alaska's tribal organizations, management, and Alaska Native corporations create complicated bureaucracy for indigenous communities looking to return sacred objects.
And in our region, repatriation claims came to all but a stop, except for our one regional tribe. So it's been a loss for us that we have not been able to continue this important work of seeking the returns of our sacred objects and our ancestors.
Wuerl says Alaska Native corporations should be eligible to initiate repatriation claims. Other people who testified encouraged shifting oversight of NAGPRA to the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Currently, much of the work is handled by the Interior Department's National Park Service. Joy Beasley is the Associate Director of Cultural Resources, Partnership, and Sciences at the Interior Department.
The Department of the Interior is aware of the inconsistencies with the way that the law is interpreted and applied across the United States, including among federal agencies. And we believe that the proposed regulatory changes will go a long ways towards clarifying the roles and responsibilities of federal agencies, as well as clarifying the timelines and the other requirements. So we're certainly aware of the issue, and we hope that the proposed regulations will address some of those challenges.
The Interior Department hired a full-time employee to investigate NAGPRA claims and violations of the law in late January. In addition to better oversight, some federal officials say there should be more funding available. From 1990 to 2020, about $50 million have been awarded to help with repatriation efforts. Anna Maria Ortiz is the Director of Natural Resources and Environment at the U.S. Government Accountability Office. That office made several recommendations to improve NAGPRA in 2010.
One of our recommendations was that agencies really figure out what they needed to do to implement the act properly and develop timelines for doing so.
Ortiz said the office got estimates from some federal departments that it could take decades and millions of dollars to go through all of their collections and figure out what they have that could be given back to tribes.
And in many cases, agencies estimated that it would cost hundreds of thousands or even millions more than they currently had appropriated to implement the act effectively.
One of the key contested points of the recommended changes to NAGPRA is how long it takes to consult with tribes after an artifact or remains are discovered. Wuerl says affected tribes should be contacted immediately, within 3 days, and not later after an agency performs its own inquiries and studies.
Consulting and informing tribal members immediately upon the discovery of any kind of human remains, that must remain in place. And I am concerned that there may be some changes in the procedures, the proposed rules, that may alter that. We need to make sure that that tribes are there right away and that we have a say in any kind of inadvertent discoveries.
In addition to the revisions to NAGPRA under consideration, another bill would make it illegal to export Native cultural items without proper authorization. The Safeguard Tribal Objects of Patrimony Act is currently in the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs. In Anchorage, I'm Trip J. Krause.
Insight Daily Radio. Federico Fajin is an internationally recognized inventor and entrepreneur who designed the world's first microprocessor, the Intel 4004, in 1971. After leaving Intel, he went on to a successful career as a high-tech entrepreneur, co-founding and leading several startup companies. He also led the development of touchpads and touchscreens, now used in nearly all mobile devices. His autobiography, Silicon, is the story of his pioneering work in the tech industry, but also his new scientific study of the mysteries of human consciousness. We spoke with him about this fascinating new book.
In 2009, I decided to retire from business and dedicate the rest of my life to the scientific study of consciousness based on the premise that consciousness is a fundamental property of nature, just like space-time and matter-energy. 2 years later, I started with my wife the Federico and Elvia Fajin Foundation, a non-profit organization to fund research on consciousness at various universities and institutions around the world. As computers have become essential in our daily lives, the media and the popular culture have promoted a vision of a future where computers have replaced humans. But in my understanding and model of consciousness, digital computers can never be conscious. They can never have the free will, intuition, creativity, empathy, and comprehension. that alone are properties of living beings. I contend that the idea that we are machines like computers is false, and it robs us of the very dimensions that makes us human.
That's Federico Fagin on his autobiography, Silicon, From the Invention of the Microprocessor to the New Science of Consciousness, which has just been released.
Insight Daily Radio.
A housing needs assessment survey is coming soon to Kodiak. Help your community by participating in the survey, which may come by mail or via a phone call. Responses are anonymous and will be incorporated in a housing needs assessment document that will be available to the public. Those who complete the survey will be entered in a prize drawing happening each week in February. This message is sponsored by Kodiak Island Housing Authority.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon. It's just about 12:30. It is currently 39 degrees at the airport. Rain and snow is likely for the rest of the day. Snow likely before 3 p.m., then rain with a high of 42 degrees. For tonight, chance of showers, then a slight chance of rain and snow with a low of 33 degrees. Your next high tide on the east side of the island is at 3:59 today. That will be 8.9 feet. And on the west side of the island, your next high tide is at 4:29. That will be 4.2 feet. Your marine weather for today in the Shelikof, there's a small craft advisory tonight. Southwest winds of 20 knots, seas 7 feet and subsiding, snow and rain. Tonight, south winds of 30 knots, seas of 7 feet. In Marmot Island, Sitkanak, there's a small craft advisory through Saturday. Southwest winds of 20 knots becoming south winds of 30 knots in the afternoon, seas of 13 feet and rain and snow. Tonight, southwest winds of 30 knots, seas of 22 feet, except 18 feet north of Dangerous Cape. And a few community announcements. There will be a Board of Education special meeting tomorrow, Saturday, February 5th, at 10 a.m. This meeting will be conducted virtually through BlueJeans. Meeting login information is posted on Kodiak Island Borough School District, their website. The website is kibsd.org. Items on the special meeting and agenda include a review of the superintendent interview process, review and set interview schedule and finalist visit, a review of stakeholder engagement forums and board roles and responsibilities. There will also be a Board of Education work session immediately followed by a special meeting on February 7th at 6:30 p.m. Those meetings will be conducted virtually, and meeting login information is also posted on the Kodiak Island Borough School District at kibsd.org. Items on the special meeting agenda include 2022 to 2023 certified non-tenured contracts. The meeting agendas and packets for the meeting can be viewed on Board Docs. That's boarddocs.com/ak/kodiak/board.nsf/public. For more information, contact Bianca Clark, Secretary to the Board of Education, at 907-486-7566. The agendas are subject to change, therefore the only official agenda is the one found online. And a notice of Kodiak Island Borough meetings. The next meeting is Saturday, February 5th at 9 a.m. at Bayside Fire Hall. Fire and following with the West Side Bayside Fire Hall. That is, there's also a meeting on February 9th at 1 p.m. That is virtual. That is the Local Emergency Planning Committee meeting.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT three times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the Midday Report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock.
If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.